You know, I am all about those little pick-me-ups throughout the day. Whether it's conquering work tasks or doing chores around the house, I need a little treat to reward me. It is a must. And you know what gets me smiling every time? Japanese snacks. Not only are they bursting with flavor, but the cute packaging and quirky vibes add an extra layer of fun. That is why teaming up with Boxu, a Japanese snack subscription box, has been an absolute delight. And these aren't your run-of-the-mill grocery store snacks, okay? Every month, Boxu brings you over 20 unique treats that you can normally find only in Japan. Plus, they throw in a nifty guide packed with info about each snack and Japanese culture. So you get to snack while you learn? Are you kidding? This was literally made for me. Oh, and by the way, each box ships straight from Japan, straight to your door. Okay, so I'm going to try one of the snacks for you. I got my little guide right here. I think this week I'm going to go for the Soka Senbei Uma Zarame. This Senbei rice cracker boasts a uniquely irresistibly tart and sweet flavor combination of ume Japanese plum and zarame, a coarse granulated sugar. Cool. Now, this says it contains wheat and soy, so that's good to know for you gluten folks. There are plenty of gluten-free snacks in here. Here's the cracker. Ooh, this looks so good. Let me give it a try. Oh my God. You hear that crunch? It's like tart. It's a little salty. It's a little sweet. Mmm. This is delicious. Mmm. And I never would have gotten to try this if Boxu hadn't sent it straight to my house. Mm. And you know, my favorite thing about Boxu is that they support small family-run businesses in Japan. Boxu has sourced your treats by working with over 245 small makers in Japan, helping out their businesses and helping to preserve their traditions. So if you love trying new and interesting things, or if you know somebody who does, you have got to try out Boxu and get these snacks shipped straight from Japan to your door. And right now, you can use the code FACTUALLY for $15 off your first order on Boxu.com. That's code FACTUALLY for $15 off your first order on Boxu.com. That's BOKKSU.com.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
I don't know the truth!
Hello, welcome to Factually. I'm Adam Conover, and look, given the absolute devastation caused by coronavirus, as I'm recording this, we've got 3 million cases and 130,000 people dead in the United States alone. You know, we don't talk about the virus in very positive terms, right? We're like, the fucking coronavirus, when's it gonna end? I hate this thing. But crucially, and this is really interesting, we also, when we talk about it, we give it intent. Right? Like news reports describe it as insidious, as though it's an evil genius which has probed human society and biology to discover our weakest points and plot some kind of invasion. We talk about the virus as moving undetected in our bloodstream before we show symptoms, like it's a cat burglar. Humans can't help but personify this thing. I mean, that's what we do. And since the novel coronavirus is doing such a good job at ruining lives, so our thinking goes, well, it must know what it's doing. But of course, with a moment's thought, we know that's not the case. Coronavirus isn't smart in any conventional human sense. In fact, it's dumb, 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 dumb. And like all viruses, it's extraordinarily simple. Viruses are made up of just bits of genetic material surrounded by protein and an outer membrane. That's it. They can't even reproduce on their own. Instead, here's how they work. They get into cells in whatever form of life they can, whether it's a plant, animal, fungi, or bacteria. And when they're in that cell, they lose the protein coding and their genetic material plugs into the infected cell's replication machinery and manufactures more of itself. A virus isn't so much an evil genius as it is a biological computer glitch or a miniature chemistry set. And not only are they incredibly bare bones, they're also tiny. For instance, the hepatitis virus is about 40 times smaller than E. coli bacteria. That's because, unlike bacteria, they don't have the machinery of life that bacteria do. You know, bacteria are complex little life forms. They can communicate, they can live inside or outside of the body, and in fact, we need bacteria to do things like help us absorb food in our gut. Although they're single-celled, bacteria can make their own energy and sustain themselves. Viruses, not so much. And compared to the simplest single-cell organisms, viruses are incredibly basic. Again, just little bits of genetic material in a tiny protein sheath. In fact, they are so simple, there is some question among scientists as to whether they're even alive. After all, they can't even replicate without a host cell. So over the course of our knowledge about them, scientists have thought of them at some times as poisons, then at other times as life forms, and then sometimes as a kind of biological chemical. Viruses exist in a biological gray area, a part of life, but not quite alive. And there's an irony in that, right? How can these fun-sized packages of genetic info have such huge, outsized impacts? How can a squirmy bit of code and protein devastate the world this way? And how is it that a tiny bit of genetic information in a simple little sheath can have such different effects on different people? Well, here today to talk to us more about viruses and educate us on this topic, our guest is Sabra Klein. She's a professor at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and is an expert on viruses and how men and women respond differently to them. Please welcome Sabra Klein. Sabra, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So you're a microbiologist at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, right? Did I get it right?
You got it correct. I am.
And you study specifically, I want to talk about everything about viruses. I want to learn a lot about viruses and coronaviruses and COVID-19 today.
Okay.
One of the things you study specifically is sex differences in coronavirus and I assume other viruses. How does that make you think differently about what we're all going through right now?
Absolutely. So, you know, as you said, I'm a microbiologist. So as a biologist, I think about some of the biological ways in which men and women differ and how well we can both recognize and respond to and hopefully clear a viral infection. And I study this both in the context of infections, but also even vaccination. So that's something else that you know, you and I could discuss as well.
Yeah.
But, you know, generally speaking, women tend to mount more robust immune responses right away, right when we first recognize that something foreign has entered our body. And in this case, if we're going to be talking about the SARS coronavirus 2 or SARS-CoV-2, as it's been abbreviated, this is a single-stranded RNA virus. So all that means for your listeners is it's a piece of RNA. And you know, viruses like SARS-CoV-2, what they do, they travel light. And as a piece of RNA, in order to live and replicate, they have to take over our own cells and utilize our own cell machinery in order to replicate. And they do that quite well. And so right when they enter, women tend to mount more robust responses. We recognize and respond to them with a greater inflammatory response, which can turn into greater what we call adaptive immune responses, which are kind of the memory responses, so that if we ever get exposed to things a second time, we you know, might be able to clear it even faster. But this often means that women tend to have less virus in them than our male counterparts. And there are some early data that have come out of Wuhan, China. I think we're waiting to see if this is replicated through other studies. But there was an interesting study that, to my knowledge, is still a preprint, but it was actually a nice study. It will likely make it easily through peer review. And it showed that even within families, women or females, I should say, this actually even included female children, tended to clear the virus faster. They weren't shedding the virus in their in the nasal swab samples for as long as the males in the family. Mm. And they did this with many families. And why I think that's important is because it controls for things like exposure. You know, because if depending on the culture, depending on the norms of that culture, you might have more men working outside of the home, or you might have situations that are resulting in greater exposure that could explain why men have more virus or shedding virus longer. But when you're in a family, you're kind of equalizing that exposure.
That's really fascinating from a research perspective. But what could that mean in terms of, you know, how we might behave differently, or like a therapy that we could come up with for the disease?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, so how I often think about this, again, from a biological perspective, if women tend to mount greater immune responses to viruses, we may also mount greater immune responses to vaccination as well. Mm. Because, you know, really all a vaccine is it's usually either a piece of the virus, so it's just a portion of the virus, or if it's a live viral vaccine, then it's usually some attenuated form of the virus. Or it's just killed virus. When the female immune system sees this, it tends to mount a greater and more robust response. And where I have historically studied this to the greatest extent is in the context of the influenza vaccine. Mm-hmm. So the vaccine that, you know, we're all supposed to go and receive seasonally.
I do my best to get it every year.
Okay, that is good to hear. That is very good to hear. I guess some good news is that SARS-CoV-2 does not seem to mutate as readily or as quickly as influenza viruses. It also does not appear to reassort. So one of the things by reassort, what I mean is that one of the things that the flu virus can do is it can take a little bit of genetic material from one strain of flu, and it can mix with genetic material from another strain and create a new strain.
And that's why we need new vaccines every year, right?
That's exactly. So, you know, I think many of us are hopeful that while we don't really know the duration of our immunity or how long that immunity lasts, we are hopeful that it will not require annual vaccinations, especially given that the SARS-CoV-2 does not appear to mutate, you know, the same way or at the same rate that we see with influenza viruses.
But you think that we might see that men and women respond differently to the vaccines once we have one?
Yeah. So, you know, much of my work has shown that these vaccines, that and it's across diverse vaccine platforms, women tend to mount greater immune responses, and there is some evidence of greater efficacy of the vaccine. And so what that means is that, you know, hopefully when we all get vaccinated, our goal and as public health practitioners is that, you know, these vaccines are going to induce the type of immunity that prevents us from getting infected. And as you know, the flu vaccine, partly because of the mutations of the virus, it's not perfect. So a lot of times you'll hear stories, hey, I got the vaccine and then I got the flu. Mm-hmm. The vaccine doesn't work. And, you know, what data suggests is that even if it isn't perfect and you do get the flu, presumably you get a much less severe form. You are significantly less likely to die than if you didn't get the vaccine. So I do think these become kind of, you know, important points to keep in mind, especially as you know, we're moving toward development. You know, we're in the midst of, you know, in many cases, phase two and even the start of some phase three clinical trials for the COVID-19 vaccine. We don't yet recommend dosaging or formulations based on whether you're a male or a female. You know, I think these are things that need to start getting considered. It may become more important to maybe even consider about boosting for men. You know, so these are things that I discuss in this type of context, but, you know, I think we're still trying to change policy. I think we've seen that happen with regard to age, you know, so we know that as we age and as we get older for vaccines, these are older adults are individuals 65 years and older. We know that because of some of the immunological decline that can occur as we age, that you know, sometimes we do need a different dose for older adults.
And so maybe we might start doing that for men and women as well eventually.
Yeah.
Well, let's take it back to basics here, because I was talking about this in the intro. Viruses are one of the weirdest things in life, I think. Like,
are they living? It's very philosophical.
Yeah. Are they? I mean, because bacteria. So I take me to this level, right? Blow my mind like I'm in, you know, virology 101, mm-hmm. right? And I'm thinking about this for the first time. Like, bacteria are alive. They're little creatures.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
But viruses are just what they're just like little. They're just what little strings of code.
Genetic
that,
material of code. Yeah. Beautifully said. Yes. They can either be RNA or they can be DNA. And really what they end up doing is they've evolved ways to utilize often receptors that we have on the surface of our cells in our body, lots of different cells, and which cells get infected often depends on which virus. But if we stick with our example of SARS-CoV-2, which again is an RNA virus, it's going to primarily infect epithelial cells. So epithelial cells lining our respiratory tract, going through our nose, down through our trachea, into our lungs. And it's going to get in there by a receptor that, you know, we have on ourselves for other physiological functions. So, you know, viruses are experts at taking advantage of things that we can't get rid of because we need them for other purposes.
So you need the lungs, the epithelial cells.
Right. And you need the receptors on a lot of these cells for other basic physiological functions. And these viruses are very good at taking advantage of this and then using those receptors to kind of get inside of our cell. And once this bit of genetic code, as you put it, is in our cell, then it can start to utilize aspects of our cell, things that are inside of our cell, things that we use for our own cellular functioning. The virus can now use to make itself into a virus particle that can then bud from a cell, and now it's living. Now it's a living virus particle. But part of what it's made of is from you. And now it can go and it can infect other cells and it can continue to replicate. And that will continue. But we have evolved to have this wonderful immune system that we have that it is wonderful, but it often takes a while, you know? So in order to genetically rearrange cells within our own body to really start to recognize and know, okay, I've got to create an army of cells that are going to recognize SARS-CoV-2. You know, people don't want to hear this, but this can take weeks. Because you're talking about genetic rearrangement of within our cells, this just takes time.
Wow.
You know, and so we have some immune responses that can be immediate, like within hours of getting exposed, and then we have other responses that are going to take days and even weeks in order to mount to really get rid of the virus. And so, you know, this is when it kind of gets into the gray area of this is when people enter into the, you know, hospital. This is when people can enter into the intensive care unit, and how well we can mount that immune response, you know, becomes really important.
Got it. Because the symptoms are immune responses, right? When you have a fever or something like that, that's your body fighting back. It's not caused directly by the virus. And so if it takes your body a couple weeks to recognize that the virus is spreading, that's why you're asymptomatic, but you're still full of virus. You have a lot of virus in you.
Yes.
I see.
An interesting point that you made is, you know, some of what you know, what doesn't take weeks for us to develop is that inflammation. That, and it does, that does contribute, as you said, that's exactly the cause for fever. That's our own immune response causing this. And some of the tissue damage that we're seeing in patients and some of the acute distress that's occurring in the lungs of patients with very severe COVID-19, which is, you know, what we call the disease that's caused by the infection with this virus.
Oh, COVID-19 is a disease. And the name you said earlier is the name of the virus.
Yes, yes.
Oh, yes. So what, and what's that name again?
So SARS-CoV-2 is the RNA virus that causes COVID-19. COVID-19 being the disease. So when you get diagnosed and you're put in the hospital, if it's severe enough, you have COVID-19, but it's caused virus. Yeah.
Got it. I never understood that. Thank you for that.
Yeah. And so it turns out that in, in almost 90% of countries around the world that are disaggregating their data, and in particular, their mortality data, and separating it for men and women, what we're finding is that men are typically at about a twofold increased risk of dying from COVID-19, and that's being shown around the world in age groups, most adult age groups. So where I've seen data broken down are starting at about age 20 on up to 90 plus years of age. So among really rather diverse ages, we're seeing that men are significantly more likely to be hospitalized, to enter into intensive care units, and to die from COVID-19. And so, you know, people like myself, we want to understand why. And there's the biology, you know, like we've been talking about, that immune response that might be contributing. But there are a lot of amazing investigators around the world also very interested in how our behaviors might be contributing to some of this. And so we often refer to some of the behaviors, maybe our lifestyle choices, things we might do that may put us at greater risk, either of exposure or of more severe outcome. We often refer to those as gender differences. When you introduced me, you know, you brought up the sex differences. That's the biological difference, you know, between a biological male and a biological female. And gender is sort of, you know, it's more in reference to some of the social or cultural norms that might influence the behaviors, the occupations, the lifestyle choices that we each might make. So, you know, as an example, in diverse countries around the world, men are significantly more likely to smoke.
Yeah.
Men are significantly less likely to wash their hands. And data show that when you've been washing their hands, men are significantly less likely to use soap. So here's my public health announcement. you know, I mean, there's anecdotal discussions. I've yet to see a study of this, but just anecdotal write-ups about, you know, the demasculinization associated with wearing masks.
Right.
And so are men significantly less likely to wear masks? And again, I have not seen data yet, but I've seen in the popular press, you know, just some discussions of this. So these become some of the gender differences. I think other examples, and this could start to be a bridge between lifestyle and our biology, some of the, what we call in science and in medicine, comorbidities. So what comorbidities are, these are other diseases that might make an individual or put an individual at greater risk of more severe outcome from COVID-19. So we've heard about things like having diabetes, being obese, having heart disease, having hypertension, are all examples of if you have some of those other diseases, you are at an increased risk of having more severe outcome. Basically what that means, you're more likely to die from COVID-19. And there probably is some biology associated with this. There might have been some behaviors that led you down that path to having some of those other disease states. But it turns out that across the board and across diverse countries, you know, you often find that these other diseases, these other comorbidities are more frequent in men as compared with women.
Yeah. I mean, it just makes me think about, this is something I've talked about on my show before, and this is not your, it's a little bit off from your area of expertise, but like, you know, there's so much talk, like even as a man, like I grew up hearing about like, man, all of these sort of social impositions that are put on women are like bad for women's health, you know, body image and eating disorders and all those sorts of things. Yeah. And it wasn't until years later, like in my 30s, until I realized that the same thing happens to men, that like all of these ideas that are spread about men, just for instance, smoking, to take that example, smoking has been advertised to men so much more over the last century. Marlboro Man and everything else. And guess what? That's deadly. And men smoke at higher rates and we die of it at a higher rate.
Yes.
And like, this is sexism, right? This is but that's so rarely in men's conversations about ourselves.
And, you know, and I do want you and your listeners to know that there are international groups who are focused on men's health, specifically, because this is becoming a public health crisis. And I think there are ways to reach men to have these discussions. Because when you start to recognize, you brought up advertising, you know, and how this can contribute to, these can contribute to some lifestyle choices that at different times, especially when we're younger, we may not recognize are going to be very detrimental, or create worse outcomes for us, later in life. And so then people like myself, I mean, you know, yes, I see myself as a women's health expert, but I also see myself as a men's health expert because mm-hmm. I really am trying to better understand why men and women and the complexities of why men and women may differ in outcomes of various diseases, thinking not only about our biology, but how behavior could be impacting this as well, you know, and, wonderful international investigators are also, you know, trying to really raise awareness that as we enter into a potential second wave of COVID-19, I think there's...
Or we already are,
especially here in the United States. But it turns out that worldwide, 70% of our frontline healthcare workers are women. You know, and so what that does to exposure, and do we start to really, you know, if we start to really, if, especially if a second wave is worse than the first wave here in the United States in particular, do we start to see increased rates of exposure, infection, and maybe worse outcomes in women, you know, as we move forward? So I do just want to put a plug in there that occupation can become very important.
Yeah.
In these discussions of differences between men and women.
So getting back to the virus itself, I know that the SARS-CoV-2, did I get it right?
Yes, absolutely.
Good. That's a complex name to remember. It is a coronavirus. Coronavirus is actually a type of virus.
Yes.
What is a coronavirus as distinct from, I remember... people saying, oh, you know, we knew a pandemic was going to come, but we thought it would be an influenza. We didn't realize it would be a coronavirus.
We did.
And so what is a coronavirus?
So typically, as we used to really think about coronaviruses, these are the viruses that typically cause the common cold. And I think as you recognize, you rarely go to a doctor for the common cold. Usually you can manage it through over-the-counter remedies or just kind of, you know, bearing through it. We really haven't worried about these coronaviruses. These are kind of referred to, if you will, as alpha coronaviruses. And other than these viruses, which we have obviously known about, these coronaviruses for a very long period of time, in 2003, we had the first emergence on record of what's referred to as a beta coronavirus. So this is a more pathogenic coronavirus. And this particular coronavirus, which we refer to as SARS-CoV, it emerged in Hong Kong, and we were really able to get it, for the most part, under control. Air travel and did result in the spread of this virus to other countries, but we really were able to keep this under control. We quickly figured out that these coronaviruses, these beta coronaviruses, were being carried by bats. And in the case of this 2003 outbreak that occurred, we identified the civet cat as an intermediate host, in a way that the virus got from bats to people was by way of this cat that was at some of these live animal markets in China. So we figured that one out. Then in around 2010, we had, and it's actually still ongoing, another outbreak of a pathogenic coronavirus. This coronavirus, this is the MERS virus, so that's for Middle East or Middle Eastern respiratory syndrome virus. So this virus is found primarily in the Middle East, and again, we have it evolved in bats. Bats transmitted this to camels, and camels then expose humans. And so many more camels and many more interactions between camels and humans occurring in the Middle East, which is why we primarily find that there. So now we have this third highly pathogenic coronavirus, the SARS-CoV-2 that you and I have been talking about. And exactly as you said, I think because these other pathogenic coronaviruses were just outbreaks, they've kind of been in limited regions of the world. We've been able to contain them.
Yeah.
Most people were not predicting that the next 100-year pandemic would be from a coronavirus. We predicted that it would be from an influenza virus, which is, you know, earlier in our discussion, we discussed they mutate easier and more rapidly. They mm-hmm. can reassort and make brand new strains that our immune system has never seen before. We really assumed that's what it would be. And I think around the world, we've got some incredible surveillance and for flu. And now, you know, let me be clear, both here in the United States and elsewhere, you know, many of us who were a part of a lot of these larger surveillance efforts were in a position to quickly transition a lot of our research to SARS-CoV-2.
And is there any, I'm just curious, were we like caught flat-footed at all because we thought it would be influenza the whole time? Like, were we sitting around with a lot of flu kits when we should have had coronavirus kits? Or not when we should have had, but...
No, you know. Yes. I mean, in some respects, I mean, we have some really decent tests in place. You know, debates about the quality of the tests and the kits for knowing if you have flu and knowing precisely which strain of flu you have, we don't have those debates because... We really are. We're set up with a very good international infrastructure to diagnose influenza, and you can know exactly which strain you were infected with, and we have wonderful monitoring in place, and I think what's been tough is, as a scientist, I think what's been most difficult is that the public is having to see sometimes in the early stages how imperfect and what the process of science really looks like. And things are often not immediate, and they're often not without fault immediately. And, you know, I realize that can be very frustrating and stressful, especially when you're in the midst of a pandemic, but accuracy in science, I mean, this takes time. This really takes deep, deep knowledge of what it is that you're developing, what it is you're testing, how you're testing. We usually get, you know, years to really hone some of what we know. And you know, the people developing these kits, you know, they were doing this on the order of weeks, not years.
Yeah.
And having to do it very publicly.
Yeah.
You know, so where before you even had a moment to maybe, you know, validate or have other labs validate, it's out there and everybody's trying to buy your kits and everybody, and then the public gets upset when, you know, they have to hear that everything maybe isn't the same and every kit isn't as accurate as every other kit. And then we get into the debates about should you be going and knowing whether you've been, you have the virus or whether you have those antibodies against the virus.
Yeah.
And, you know, and these are the challenges. And I, you know, my hope is that it doesn't erode faith in science, but more just an appreciation that science is a process. Mm-hmm. And it's usually a process that does take time for us to do it in as accurate and thorough and we replicate things to know that we can believe what we're seeing. And right now we're giving you guys everything hot off the press.
Yeah. Just not a situation that scientists are used to being in or that the public is used to being in as regards science. Like normally we don't give that much of a shit about the cutting edge science, right? Where we'll wait 5 years for it to be solid.
Absolutely. And now in real time, you know, you're having us come on shows like this, you know, to have fabulous discussions. But a year from now, if some of what I've said on here is wrong, this is my disclaimer.
Yeah.
You know, that we're still in the early stages and things may shift and we may find that the storyline is changing as we continue to understand more about the virus, more about how to measure the virus, more about our immune system, how to measure those immune responses, how long those immune responses last. I get asked that all the time. And I think most of us, it's a very unsatisfying thing to say, but we don't know. You know, we presume because it is a virus and it's in a family of viruses that you know, virologists are familiar with, that there will be long-lived immunity, but that's yet to have been shown. And there are a lot of aspects of this particular pathogenic coronavirus that just doesn't seem to completely fit even, you know, with other pathogenic coronaviruses. So we're still learning with you, but yet we also have to share some of our expertise in real time. I think it's important. I think that's our role, that we should be doing that. And I can't tell you as a scientist how just how both emotional as well as motivating it is to see the public interest in wanting to know so much about a virus and wanting to know so much about their immune system, how their immune system functions. I mean, this is exciting, you know, this is what, you know, I mean, it's good.
Well, I mean, on that note, I have a lot more questions for you about this, but we have to take a really quick break. We'll be right back with more CyberKline. Folks, today's sponsor is one I cannot recommend highly enough, Delete Me. As a Factually listener, you know how much I value online privacy. Well, Delete Me has been an indispensable tool for me for many years. I've been using them long before they even started advertising on this show. This day and age, it is shockingly simple for data brokers to peddle your personal information without your consent. These data brokers may be selling your name, phone number, and home address, and you might never even know it's happening. Trying to locate and remove all this data yourself can feel like an impossible task, but that is where Delete Me shines. Their team of experts tirelessly scour the web to track down and wipe out your personal data. In just 7 days, you will receive a detailed report of their findings. And believe it or not, a whopping 41% of Americans are vulnerable to online harassment, from doxing to scams and even identity theft. In some cases, having your info online can turn cyber stalking into good old-fashioned in-person stalking. Protect yourself from these threats with Delete Me. So if you're like me and you value your personal privacy, you want to make sure that your identifying personal details are not floating around the internet where anybody can buy them, well, you can get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/Adam and use promo code Adam at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/Adam, code Adam. I wholeheartedly recommend this service. Check out Delete Me.
Today's show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Our lives are super demanding these days. I know that I constantly catch myself wishing for extra hours in the day. But here's the thing. The problem isn't as simple as lack of time. It's that we often have trouble prioritizing what's actually important to us, whether that's seeing friends, talking to family, or even kicking back with a good book. This is one of the ways that therapy can be so valuable. Working with a professional can help you figure out your priorities and make time for the stuff that really matters. And therapy isn't just for big trauma. We can all use a little help, whether it's learning to deal with stress, setting boundaries, or just getting stuff off your chest. So if you're thinking about giving therapy a shot, you might check out BetterHelp. They say it's all online, super flexible, and fits right into your busy life. You just answer a few questions, and they say that they will hook you up with a licensed therapist. Plus, you can switch therapists at any time, no extra charge. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/factually today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/factually. Hey, everybody, I know we're in the ad break, but we're doing something a little bit different today. Today, I'm going to tell you about an amazing group of people who did not pay us anything to be a part of the show. We just think they do amazing work, and we wanted you to know about them. You might remember back in 2018, those heart-wrenching stories of families torn apart by Border Patrol, refugee children being pulled away from their parents who were in turn deported to their home countries. It was devastating then, and it's just as devastating now, with hundreds of families still not reunited after all these years. You know, we discuss so many problems on Factually, but I firmly believe that there is always something that can be done about those problems. And recently, I came across an organization called Al Otro Lado, which works to reunify families. They provide holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees, deportees, and other migrants in the U.S. and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm reduction-based practice. Since 2018, they have successfully brought together over 100 families torn apart by Trump's zero tolerance policy. But reuniting those families is just the beginning. Al Otro Lado continues to support each family with legal aid, housing, and counseling to help heal and get back on their feet. I mean, can you imagine the agony of having your child ripped from your arms, unsure of when you'll see them again? We cannot allow such family separations to continue. So if you're like me and believe that all families belong together, then join me in supporting Al Otro Lado and donate today. You can find the link to donate to Al Otro Lado in the description of this episode or go to gum.fm/charity and donate today. You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities that are both in-person and virtual. The best way to get involved is by filling out an application on their website at alotrolado.org/volunteer. Thank you so much.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, we're back with Sabra Klein. Something I was thinking about over the break, again, when you're talking about health differences between men and women and their different health vulnerabilities, I think all the time about how much more blind men are to those differences. Like, I feel like women know, yeah, oh man, they're susceptible to this, or again, this is a cultural pressure that's placed on women, yeah, that's unhealthy. Men tend to deny it in women sometimes and say, oh, that's not really a problem. And then they tend to not see it in themselves. They tend not to notice, or it's just not part of our dialogue. And I'm just curious if you have any idea about why that might be, because it perplexes me.
Okay, so your anecdotal observation is backed up by solid data.
Wow, and then, really?
Yeah, so 2 points that I'll make. So first, let's go off what you ended with. You know, men are significantly less likely to take advantage of healthcare in countries where healthcare is available equally to men and women, because unfortunately we get to take that for granted here in the United States, but that's not the case elsewhere. Women, yeah, often in various countries do not have equal access. So if you have equal access, men are significantly less likely to take advantage of healthcare and wow, seek out healthcare. So, you know, going back to why could COVID be more severe? Maybe if you're not paying attention to your symptoms or you're ignoring your symptoms, you may be waiting too long before seeking out care.
I see.
And finally seeking that care out at a point where the disease has become more serious. So absolutely, you know, there are data to speak to that. But, you know, one of the, a point or how I interpreted a point that you made, so please correct me if my interpretation was incorrect, you know, about women being disregarded, for, you know, if you will, some of their aches and pains, and there are actually data that speak to this, and how many times, unidentifiable pain or symptoms that don't fit nicely into the repertoire of symptoms for a particular disease. And I think where this has been studied the best is in the context of heart disease, where women often experience not gripping pain, but rather this very nondescript feeling of indigestion and pressure.
But I've heard of this.
Okay. And part of that is because the way that that the calcium buildup in the blood vessels, it's often more evenly distributed in blood vessels from females as compared with males. Males, you tend to get a clumping in one place until eventually it just completely blocks and you have an explosion, and that explosion and gripping pain is really characteristic of the quote unquote male heart attack. Women, it tends to be more of a, of an even distribution, of that buildup. And as a result, it's kind of a slow leak, and that slow leak results in this nondescript feeling or reported feeling of indigestion and some pressure and discomfort. And there are data showing that even in studies that have been designed in which case reports are written up and handed to physicians, can be the exact same case report. All you're doing is you're changing the name and you're making it a stereotypical female sounding name or stereotypical male sounding name. And it turns out that if in these vignettes or these descriptions of having, you know, heart related symptoms, if it mentions nothing about stress or other aspects of a person's life, physicians, both men and women, are likely to diagnose both with having heart disease. The moment you mention things about life stresses, maybe care of an elderly family member or divorce, you mentioned just anything little, just throw in one line that there's a stressor, the men still get correctly diagnosed as having heart disease, and the women, it gets turned into a psychiatric recommendation. And there are absolutely data of, you know, to show that women are significantly more likely to, when experiencing heart disease, be sent for a psychiatric evaluation. So I do think some of this, you know, when, you know, it may not be complaining, it may be being in touch with your body and knowing your body and knowing when you're not feeling, you know, right. So I do think we're all of this, you know, I mean, I think, you know, these different biases, they're playing out. I think COVID-19 is revealing on so many levels inequities. And some of it may be based on gender, as you and I have been talking about, but, you know, it is not my expertise at all. I just get to be surrounded by people who know a lot about health equity in the context of race and ethnicity. And I think a lot of what you and I have been talking about fit there too.
Yeah. That, I just go for it, please.
No. You know, just that, you know, if you don't have access to care or you have certain comorbidities, you may be at greater risk. And we're seeing, you know, that play out in especially in the United States, where we're seeing disproportionately more Black people ending up with severe COVID-19.
I just think it's so, I find this topic fascinating, these biases, because they play out in different ways for different genders, right? And so often for women, it's, you know, not being taken seriously by other people, right? For men, often it's not being taken seriously almost by yourself, right? By having
Well said.
Internalized that thing about, you know, oh, I'm a strong man. I feel no pain. Yeah. I engage in risky behavior. Mm-hmm. I don't go to see the doctor. And it's those same men who are not taking the biases that are exhibited towards women seriously, you know? And I really hope that one of the reasons I'm fascinated by the topic is I hope that if men start realizing, oh no, like I've internalized things, there are things about masculinity that have been internalized, that I've internalized that are hurting my health, right?
Yes.
Like, oh, every cigarette ads, alcohol ads have been aimed yes. at me my entire life. That's hurt my health. Then maybe they might start thinking, oh wait, maybe that thing that my wife or girlfriend or, you know, woman in my life is talking about, maybe that's not so crazy. Maybe yes. maybe that is a real thing. Maybe yes. they have a version of that too. Because this is, yeah, I don't think this is an equally distributed problem. I think women probably bear the brunt of it. But it's, I don't know. It's just funny how we as men often have a special sort of blindness, mm-hmm. even when it's about ourselves.
Right. It's true. And, you know, I mean, I'll take this to the next level.
Please.
You know, moving beyond just COVID-19, you and I could look across very diverse diseases, some of which are infectious, others of which are not. And I will tell you that, you know, it all contributes to why lifespan longevity is significantly lower for men than for yeah. women across diverse countries. Even in low to middle income countries where overall life expectancy is lower than what we are lucky enough to experience here in the United States, you still see this breakdown where women are significantly, you know, they live significantly longer than their male counterparts, you know? So I do think, you know, there is something to this concept of, you know, the culture of masculinity. And it's not to say that every aspect of it needs, you know, that, you know, we've got yeah. to become this, you know, androgynous community. Nobody is saying that, but it's trying to weigh the costs and benefits and figure out where could there be room for improvement. And I think being attentive to your own health is a good thing.
And maybe being willing to put a mask on.
Yes,
to protect not
thing.
Just yourself but others. Yeah, it's a good thing.
It is. And it's yes, and it's not I think we've got to change the perception so that it isn't that it's a sign of a threat to one's masculinity. Or I mean, we're seeing, you know, it play out as being perceived as a threat to personal liberty and rights. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think this, you know, it's about perception, and sometimes public health, whether we talk about wearing a mask or being vaccinated, it's as much about protecting you as an individual and as it is protecting your neighbors and other people in your communities.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, we've not been put in this type of situation, at least not in my generation. So I do think there's a tremendous need to try to work together to change some of these perceptions so that we are working together
yeah.
to get through this. And it is going to require buy-in from everybody and some, you know, and that's easier for some than for others.
We may not get it from everybody, but I hope we can get it from as many as people as possible.
Yes. Well, I mean, because that's, you know, that's public health.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I mentioned vaccines, you know, we still don't have a vaccine. I think, you know, there's a lot of hope for one by the end of the year. I tend to not, you know, be quite, you know, I think we're probably going to see it become available in 2021. Mm-hmm. And part of why vaccines are going to become so important is that concept that we've been hearing about, you know, in the media about herd immunity. You know, it's getting yeah. enough of us to have some immunity that we create breaks in the transmission cycle of the virus, so that as that virus, as we described, as it takes over your cellular machinery and it buds out of your cells and you sneeze and now the virus particles are going out, if there's nobody in the vicinity who isn't susceptible. So hopefully everybody in that vicinity is immune, maybe through vaccination or, you know, exposure, that we provide breaks in the transmission cycle. And that's going to be our only way to really stop this pandemic.
Yeah. But it strikes me that masks and social distancing work the same way,
yes,
in that if you have enough people doing, I knew about herd immunity from just knowing about vaccines. And, you know, we've been talking about that for years in terms of the flu virus, et cetera. At least it's in my work, it's come up a lot. But the same thing applies to masks, right? That if you've got enough people, if you've got 90% of the population wearing masks, that cuts enough of the vectors that it's a lot less likely for it to spread, even when you do have that one person in the environment who is infected.
The virus needs you and I to live. That's the only way. It once you kind of break that transmission cycle and it goes out there and it lands just somewhere in the environment on the sidewalk, but because we were 6 feet apart and it landed in the sidewalk and not on one of us, now it's going to die there.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so, like you said, I think mask wearing combined with the social distancing today, that's what we have. I mean, that's where we each have some control, you know, and washing hands, but that is, and I think, you know, those are important messages as another way of trying to break these transmission cycles before we have, you know, mass vaccination.
A lot of people are curious about how I have friends who are pregnant right now or who have just given birth.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm very frightened for them, or at least I'm concerned when seeing their Instagram posts. I don't pester them about it, but how do those things interact since we're on the topic of sex differences and
absolutely,
and coronavirus?
Absolutely. So there you have a female specific condition, you know, getting pregnant, and the data that we have thus far, and there's some pretty decent studies that have been published out of China, as well as out of the United Kingdom, really suggesting that it is a very rare event for pregnant women to have severe outcomes from COVID-19. So in this moment, we don't have a lot of evidence to suggest that pregnancy is associated with more severe outcome. Those rare cases are in cases where maybe women have, they maybe have other underlying conditions, you know, so which would also make them, you know, at greater, you know, at have having, you know, an at-risk pregnancy, preeclampsia, you know, gestational diabetes, some of these factors. But those are the exceptions, not the rule. So, you know, so for any of your pregnant friends or colleagues, generally speaking, they should be okay unless they do have other conditions that mean that, you know, they are at greater risk for severe outcomes associated just with pregnancy. We also do not have ample evidence to suggest that should a woman become infected during pregnancy, that she will transmit the virus to her baby.
Oh, okay.
So I do think that's important as well, because, you know, I think for all families, you know, you're worried both about the pregnant woman, but also about the fetus. And, you know, we do not have, we don't have much evidence. And again, it's been a rare case where there's been some suggestion of a possible infection in utero infection. So infection during pregnancy, but, For the most part, we are seeing that most pregnant women who even might become infected during pregnancy are giving birth to healthy babies.
And my understanding is that for whatever reason, this virus doesn't particularly like babies are not at particular risk for it for some reason. Is that right? And why is that?
So I think we're still, I think the verdict is still out as to whether babies, because that's such a susceptible group for lots of things.
Yeah.
But if you'll allow me to expand your point, Please. Which I think was your point, just, you know, that young children, you know, so broadly speaking, young children seem to be spared. Yes, I think you're completely correct. I think there are some rare conditions that are showing up. So we are seeing some unusual neurological consequences of infection in children, but they tend to be, at least at this stage, in this moment of the pandemic, rather rare, mm-hmm. More the exception than the norm. Most children do seem to be spared from severe outcomes from COVID-19. You are completely correct. And, you know, people are studying this, everything from the immune system to the expression of those receptors that I was telling you that the virus needs to use to get into our cells. Are there differences in the expression of these receptors? Do kids not have as much so the virus can't get in as easily? I mean, there are some pretty cool studies that are being conducted now. But it is a very unusual pattern. A much more typical pattern would be that the very young and the very old are at greatest susceptibility to viral infections. Yeah. But that's not what we're seeing. So, you know,
that's,
and I think
lucky,
that's,
in a way
it is, I actually agree with you. I think again, you know, you try to find, you know, where we can maybe feel some relief. And I think we can feel relief that by and large children are being spared, and by and large pregnant women are being spared, and you know that's the future, that's the future of our society. And yeah. You know, it is we don't want anyone to be dying from this, and that's why we're all working 24/7 to try to figure this out. And you know, it is not to say that older adults in any of our lives should be suffering like this, and we're trying to figure this out. But I think, you know, the fact that children and pregnant women are spared is absolutely a relief.
But that's not a given. And it could be that, you know, another pandemic occurs in the future, which is kills a lot of children.
Well, you know, you know, you and I were around for the 2009 H1N1 pandemic, which was a yeah. flu pandemic. You know, part of why it wasn't anything like this is because, you know, we all have some level of what we would call pre-existing immunity to influenza viruses because mm. we've all lived with them our whole lives, mm-hmm. You know, to help protect us. But there was a great example where, you know, pregnant women were at significantly greater risk of being hospitalized with severe influenza. And that was having, while pregnant women were not transmitting the virus to their babies, they were experiencing some negative outcomes. And that can be everything from, you know, early delivery to having low birth weight babies, to even death. So, you know, we have seen that, and I think it is still a relief that at least in this particular pandemic, we're not seeing that. But it's not to say everybody shouldn't be vigilant. I think we all should be.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't think, you know, just because you're not maybe in an at-risk group doesn't mean you shouldn't be wearing a mask, washing your hands, social distancing.
Yeah. Well, this has been such a wake up call. You know, it makes me think of I lived in New York City when Hurricane Irene hit. Oh, wow. New York and, yeah. and Vermont and you know, yes. New England. And it, and you know, there was all this news about it. And then New York was mostly spared, and people said, oh, that was overhyped. Like, come on, it's not that big a deal. And then the next year was Hurricane Sandy, right? It's the very next
gosh.
Year.
Yes.
And this reminds me of that we had all those other H1N1 and SARS. And, oh, and yeah. by the way, how strange is it the way we name these diseases publicly? Because you said that what we call SARS was yes. SARS-CoV-1, right?
Yes.
And then this one that we now call coronavirus is SARS-CoV-2. We might as well just call it SARS-2.
Right, but we don't.
We've chosen this name that's based on the category of the whole category of virus. No comment on why that it just takes hold somehow, a name like that in the press, and then we all start calling it that. But
oh, we have big important people who name our viruses.
Okay.
I want them still to like me.
Well, I actually don't mean the official name. I mean like the name the public chooses.
It's,
you know,
terrible. It is terrible.
We could have a little bit more. I don't know. We could get a little more
systematic way of managing some of these names. Agreed.
Well, because it makes me I didn't realize until now that, oh, wow, what we call SARS and what we call coronavirus are so directly the same type of thing that would be useful in our conversations to sort of like improving our understanding of public health. But so in any case, so this feels like, you know, Hurricane Sandy, right, compared to Hurricane Irene. All right, we're taking it seriously. But then when... you know, I start hearing that, all right, like actually this one, we got lucky. It's not killing children at a high rate, right?
Yes.
That makes me think, well, hold on a second. This could happen again next year. There's no reason, you said 100-year disease, 100-year pandemic. No reason that can't happen more than once every century.
It's so true.
So do you have that concern that there's an even deadlier version around the corner? And do you think that we're going to be more awake to that now?
I think we will be more awake to that. I think we'll be more awake to the, I think the public is more awake to that. And so their demand for funding research on diverse viruses, it's going to be, the money will be there to allow for this kind of surveillance for more than one type of virus. I sleep at night, so I don't live in fear, and I would never want your listeners, you know, and we work with these viruses every day. And you know, I think we all have to be vigilant and use common sense and be smart and think about our neighbors, but you got to also still, you know, find balance and live your life and let your children out of the house. And
yeah.
You know, yeah.
Do you just at this very moment in time, and this might be a good moment to end on, where
absolutely,
you know, we had this really severe lockdown. Everyone took coronavirus or took SARS-CoV-2 very, very seriously for a period of months. And then it sort of felt like, okay, we've got to reopen. We've been doing this long enough. Numbers are going down. And as we're speaking, our numbers are going up again. Look at the graphs. We're once again spiking. We like didn't even really have a dip. We had what looks like a plateau and then another spike. Just here in LA County, they've closed bars again. It's starting to look like they opened too soon. In the entertainment industry, my industry, people were a month ago, they were talking about, oh, we'll be shooting again soon. Now people are saying maybe not until 2021. What do you think about the public response? How do you grade it? What should we have been doing differently? And what should we be doing differently now?
I know that's a big question. It's a huge question, you know, and I guess I could answer it in so many different ways. But, you know, I think we have fatigue, and that fatigue has resulted in people wanting to get out, wanting to do things, go to the bars, as you said, maybe no longer social distance. And as a result, we are seeing cases climb. You know, I realize that, you know, I keep bringing up this 100-year pandemic, you know, the 1918 influenza pandemic. I recognize that there was a war going on, World War I. It was a terrible backdrop for a pandemic and did contribute to the spread of the virus and just the incredible levels of death. But in that first wave, you know, you were talking about roughly 3 to 5 million deaths. That second wave, you were talking about 30 to 50 million. Wow. You know, second waves are real. And I think that... that fatigue and that feeling like we can't do these stay at home orders. We can't, you know, we've got to figure out that smart balance that our economy cannot stay shut. There are smart ways to think about how we do these reopenings. And I think we're seeing what happens when you rush to do it too quickly. And yeah. You know, we are entering, or we are in that second wave. And I think we have fatigue, and you know, this isn't, you know, much like a sexually transmitted disease. I mean, you know, we could have dealt maybe with HIV if people could abide by, okay, so just stop having unprotected sex. It's that simple. And then it exploded into something else, because public health is so simple yet so difficult to abide by.
Yeah. But with HIV, like, it's not like abstinence is the only answer, right?
Condoms.
And all other different types of methods that you can take, right, while still having a sex life.
Absolutely. Right? Absolutely.
And so with coronavirus, or with SARS-CoV-2, I'm going to be precise right now. The reopening, my understanding is that's an emergency measure you take to clamp it down while you put the other measures in place, while you put
absolutely
contact tracing in place. For instance, I heard a lot of talk about contact tracing as being
absolutely, and
it's been 4 months later, and I'm like, where's the contact tracing? Like, are you
it's happening. Absolutely. But I think, you know, like what you're seeing, I think in cases where masks can't be worn, like when we're eating and we're drinking, social distancing becomes even more important. And so that's where we're running into our problems is, you know, you're in situations where people can't wear a mask. So, you know, probably for different, you know, you mentioned about, you know, Hollywood, and you can't make your movies and have all your actors and actresses with masks on. So if people can't wear masks, then you've got to have absolute social distancing in place.
Yeah.
It's where we decide we're going to get rid of masks, and we're going to reduce social distancing. That's where we're having problems.
Well, I thank you so much for being here. Any other final thoughts to share with the audience?
This has been lovely. I've really enjoyed this. So thank you.
Thank you. So I learned so much, and I really thank you taking the time to talk to us about this.
Thank you.
Well, thank you again to Dr. Sabra Klein for coming on the show. I hope you enjoyed that conversation as much as I did. If you did, please leave us a rating or a review wherever you subscribe. It really does help us out. Just hit the back button on your podcast player. Hit that 5-star button. We'd appreciate it so much. That is it for us this week on Factually. I want to thank our producers, Dana Wickens and Sam Roudman, our engineers, Ryan Connor and Brett Morris, Andrew WK for our theme song. I'm Adam Conover. You can find me at adamconover.net or at Adam Conover, wherever you get your social media. And until next week, we'll see you next time on Factually.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. The Daily Show podcast has everything you need to stay on top of today's news and pop culture. You get hilarious, satirical takes on entertainment, politics, sports, and more from Jon and the team of correspondents and contributors. The podcast also has content you can't get anywhere else, like extended interviews and a roundup of the weekly headlines. Listen to The Daily Show, Ears Edition, wherever you get your podcasts.